It's Wednesday, March 15, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On the program this week, the new Missing Richard Simmons podcast. Could it be the new serial? It's Sunshine Week, and that means there's a bit more light shining on those standing in the way of a free flow of information, like the mayor of a town outside of Seattle who sent the local newspaper a bill asking a question of the city attorney, and a local television news broadcast produced more than 150 miles away. That's right, Toledo TV viewers are now getting their local news from anchors in South Bend. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well before our time is up today, but let's start with the teased heavily to break on the Rachel Maddow show, only to be scooped by the Daily Beast and the White House itself. The release of two pages of President Donald Trump's 2005 tax returns. How did those two pages that Rachel Maddow so breathlessly held up after her 18-minute monologue and 2.5-minute commercial end up in her hands?
Well, she got them from reporter David K. Johnson, who's won a Pulitzer Prize before, who's written about the wealthy and their taxes. Somebody stuck it in his mailbox, he claimed, kind of like what happened with the New York Times in those couple of pages from Trump's taxes before, and he shared them with Rachel Maddow. Now, you can imagine that Rachel Maddow wanted to milk this for everything she could, because MSNBC's ratings have been through the roof since Trump has been elected president, and here was another opportunity to beat Fox News and CNN, but I think they tried a little too hard to promote it.
She kind of beat herself.
Well, I mean, to me, it's one of those things where, give me the news, and then give me the punditry if that's what your show is about, but you've got to start off, and if you've got something like this, you break it, and then you go to the other thing. And I think she wanted to sort of have this sort of, you know, play it up and then spring the surprise kind of thing.
So she brought all the context, brought the news.
I
wonder if she would have led that same way had she not, at least in hindsight, made the mistake of tweeting an hour or more before her show, "We've got Trump tax returns tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern time." Well, that gave the White House at least a signal that it was coming out, and they got ahead of the story. And once they got it out there, the New York Times and HuffPo and a lot of other people picked it up. So it wasn't breaking news anymore.
And it's difficult to have breaking news now, especially when, you know, if she received it, then there are several other people who received it, and it's just a question of who's going to send the tweet out first, which is what she did. Mm-hmm. But then you've got to follow that up with some sort of substance before you start going to the punditry.
One of the things, too, that the White House was saying is it would be illegal for her or anyone else to publish these documents or the information in it. She right away said, no, it's not. The First Amendment protects me here. Where's the truth between those two stories, those two lines?
The line basically is that if a journalist solicits illegal activity, then obviously that's illegal. If they are the recipients of stolen documents or whatever, they certainly have the right to publish them.
And this goes back to the fact that Trump now, and has been for a long time, a public figure.
Yes.
So there, the whole malice thing and that sort of thing doesn't even come into play here. And as Mike said, you know, if someone walks up to a journalist and say, here's some information that I think you need to have on a public figure, then there's an obligation on the part of the journalist to provide that information to the public.
Well, and David K. Johnston has said, too, he has some theories himself about how these wound up in his personal mailbox at home. Chief among them, he thinks it's the Donald who sent it.
Well, that's a fun theory to spread. I mean, it may be true. I don't know. I mean, he has leaked stuff before about himself and his family. Right. But I don't think this would likely be something that he would have leaked because, for one thing, even though it does show that he paid some taxes, millions of dollars in taxes in 2005, and like what the New York Times was suggesting, that he hasn't paid taxes for a long time, it also shows that because he took advantage of the minimum alternative tax that wealthy people are subject to, that he paid a lot more than he would have otherwise.
Well, yeah, what is the rate he's paying was 25%, and their middle class people who are paying a higher tax rate than that. I mean, that is the issue that I think really needs to be sought out, investigated, and to show that what's happening with our tax code is that there are ways in which we've known for a long time that the ultra wealthy can get by with the and pay lower taxes at this lower rate. That's the story.
And he has long said he's against the alternative minimum tax.
Well, yeah, but he's definitely taken it. But he's also said that as long as it's there, I'm going to take advantage of it.
It's also interesting to me, and we'll see whether there's any more pressure on people to leak his tax returns as it relates to the whole investigation of the connections to Russia. So, I mean, because clearly the full tax returns, not these couple of pages excerpts, could shed some light on that.
Okay, well, remember during the campaign, then-candidate Trump said that if elected, he would donate all but $1 of his salary to charity. Well, now that he's received his first paycheck, reporters want to keep him honest.
President Trump donated his paycheck from the month of February, like he promised to do during the campaign.
The president's intention right now is to donate his salary at the end of the year, and he has kindly asked that you all help determine where that goes. The way that we can avoid scrutiny is to let the press corps determine where it should go. He will. In all seriousness, I think his view is he made a pledge to the American people. He wants to donate it to charity. And he'd love your help to determine where it should go.
Might I suggest the Correspondents Association for a scholarship?
That would be a great way to do it.
I don't know. Is this one of those jokes that maybe didn't translate so well in the press room, or you think this is really seriously the plan?
I have no idea. I mean, because when we went to look at what his charitable contributions were during the campaign, it was, you know, free golf. You know, was a lot of what he had given away in terms of his charity. If he wants to give up his $400,000 salary to a charity of the journalist's choice, I think they ought to call him on it. Name something. Put something out there.
I've got to say, though, less than 2 months into his presidency with all the other stuff that's going on, I'd call this kind of a big nothing burgers. Mm-hmm. And I think the journalists should check on it from time to time. But it's not a news story until it's maybe a year in and he hasn't given his money. And I frankly think for once, and you won't hear me saying a lot so far about Sean Spicer that's positive, he suckered those journalists into that by saying, oh, the president says you should help pick. Nothing they say,
There's no good outcome.
But going back to your point, I don't even understand why this is a question. With everything else that's going on, why would you ask that question? You know, he's only been in office. I mean,
he's gotten a paycheck.
One paycheck.
It feeds the gotcha narrative that the Trump White House would like you to believe about the press.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we have a lot of other things I want to talk about today that have nothing to do with Donald Trump. So let's start by talking about new surveillance video that's been seen for the first time this past Saturday night in a public screening of a documentary at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin, Texas. It shows a different perspective, a different theory as to what Michael Brown was doing at the convenience store on the day that he was shot and killed by police officer Darren Wilson.
In the early hours of August 9th, just 11 hours before Mike took his last steps, he went to his local convenience store to make an exchange. Look carefully at the counter, and you can see a trade is made. Mike gives the store a little bag of weed. You can see the employees smelling it and passing it around. Mike traded the store a little bag of weed and got two boxes of cigarillos in return. He left his items at the store and he went back the next day to pick them up. Mike did not rob the store.
First reactions, either to seeing the new video or the idea or the premise of what's in this documentary?
Well, you know, I looked at it. Mm-hmm. I looked at it again. I listened to it without viewing it to hear what it was, all these suppositions as to what happened. And it's kind of difficult to discern whether there was an exchange of weed for the cigarillos or did he come back, that sort of thing. And I'm trying to figure out what is the point that you're trying to make, and what does it mean to the overall case of Michael Brown? The overall what happened with Darren Wilson? I mean, it seems to want to disprove what the others out there were saying about him being engaged in this sort of nefarious exchange and that sort of thing. But it doesn't get to the point that what happened on that street between Darren
Later
Wilson, the police officer, and Michael Brown. During his death, his murder.
I can understand the family if they believe that this is in fact what happened, that they want to get this video out there. I don't think seeing is believing. I mean, from either point of view, I mean, does it prove that this was a friendly exchange as opposed to a robbery? No. Does it prove that there a robbery occurred? No. It just muddies the water This video was itself edited, just as the police and prosecutors put out their piece of video trying to make Michael Brown look bad in the wake of the killing. Here we have the family putting out an edited portion of the video, which does not, for example, show the clerk in the store putting the cigarillos back on the shelf. If it was supposed to be him coming back for his, you know, cigarillos in exchange for the weed, why would they be putting the tobacco back on the shelf? So there's a lot of things about this that are just not cleared up. But it does say one thing. I mean, it certainly says that folks are not at all done with this story, right, because it is so emblematic of a bigger problem.
It is. And that's to me, that's the issue. It's emblematic of a bigger problem that when you put this out there, it sort of dismisses, but it diverts attention away from what the bigger problem is. Because this story and this video is getting all the coverage, and not what kinds of reforms are being put in place, not only in Ferguson, but across the country, in how police and communities of color deal with each other. That's the issue that I think needs to be addressed. I'm not dismissing what happened to Michael Brown or the hardship that his family is going through, because I think that's important as well. And another part of the story that needs to be covered. But this just diverts attention away from both of those.
I was also, you know, a little bit disappointed with the way a couple of the media organizations that covered this story covered it.
Okay.
For example, The Hollywood Reporter did a review of the film that showed at South by Southwest. That's where this all came out. And basically, the reporter just took the filmmaker's word for it that this new video was damning. It may or may not be, but it didn't seem like that. The New York Times, which picked up on this and ran a more nuanced story about it, still played front and center this brand new video, but did not show the older video. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch, on the other hand, the local medium in that community, showed everything and gave a really detailed
story. Well, you know, CNN did the same thing. They only showed the new part of the video, then they interviewed the maker of the video, but they never really went back and looked at the video that had gone out there at the time.
So I will say this as well. When I first saw the story on the New York Times' website and chose the clip that I wanted to play for our discussion today, I had actually found a minute 38 clip that I wanted to use that was on the New York Times website that laid out a lot more of what the assertions were, and got an email late last night from Travis McMillan, our director, saying, hey, that video doesn't match up anything that you said you wanted to do. The video that's currently on the New York Times story that we drew today's clip from is a new video that replaced the original one that does have some captioning and some more context and some explanations and some reactions from prosecutors, from other people involved.
But it also did not have the original video that the police released, which showed the whatever you want to call it. Did he strong arm the clerk? Or whatever, however you want to describe that. That video was not on the New York Times.
But I go back to what I just said. We're sitting here talking about the video, and we're not talking about the issues.
I think there was one piece of video that was really interesting that I saw by accident the other day, and that's what, looking at Facebook Live, there was a protester live streaming outside the convenience store calling for a boycott, and that shows you the power of social media now for anybody to broadcast from there.
Okay, well, this is Sunshine Week, a national initiative that's spearheaded by the American Society of News Editors to educate the public about the importance of open government and the dangers of excessive and unnecessary secrecy. That's what makes the timing of a joint editorial from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the Kansas City Star apropos. You can read the whole thing on our links blog, but basically, the two editorial boards came together to call on Governor Eric Greitens to open a dialogue with the news media and to be accountable to the people of Missouri. At the heart of this message, it's time to be transparent about secret fundraising and about spending.
Well, I mean, our governor's taken the play right out of the Trump playbook. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's I'm only going to engage with the media when I want. And when I do engage with them, it's going to be in an adversarial way, because that is what is working, or appears to be working, for the Trump administration. Why don't I do that on a state level? What I find to be unprecedented is the two largest newspapers in the state coming together to basically say, look, we're not going to engage in this kind of back and forth with you. We expect transparency because you ran on transparency. You said that you were going to do these things, and now we're holding you to the standard that you set. So I think is going on. Whether Greitens does that, I'm not sure.
I wish I could be optimistic that the joint editorial would make any difference. I mean, they point out that Missouri voters voted like 2-1 in favor of Sunshine around political contributions, but I don't know that voters really care that much. And frankly, here the governor and his people have set up this new nonprofit group called A New Missouri Inc. Yeah. that basically can take any amount of money without revealing who gave the money and can use it to advance the governor's message. That's the opposite of transparency.
I mean, I agree with you. I don't think the public is going to care until something comes up that they don't agree with, and then all of a sudden they'll care. And it depends on how long they're going to care, because we have that short attention span going now. So, you know, who knows?
Okay, well, this next one I have got to tell you. It has gotten me so high up on my soapbox. It comes out of Langley, Washington, about 40 miles outside Seattle. Last week, the city's mayor emailed the Whidbey News Times a bill for $64. It was a fee, he said, that the newspaper needed to pay for asking the city attorney a question about sanctuary city legislation under consideration. My head was exploding reading some of the initial reports on this, being called ludicrous, ridiculous, and on what planet something like this could ever occur.
Well, and of course, after this thing blew up in the regional media and on social media, the mayor was quoted as saying, I was just doing it to get your attention.
Oh,
I wasn't really billing you. He sent them a bill.
He also said that, you know, he was new to the office, which he has been in for many years.
Right. Well, he also said it costs a lot of money. We pay the city attorney a lot of money. His time is very valuable. You shouldn't be wasting his time. Come to us with your questions, not to him.
And the whole premise is that the city attorney works for the city.
Who's getting paid by tax dollars.
Yeah. And cities are like, well, you know, but the reporter doesn't live in the city. What does that have to do with it? They're asking a question in which they're going to take that information and relay it to the citizens of that community. And you're saying we're going to bill you for billable hours?
I know. I'm laughing. I'm sitting here laughing because it truly is laughable.
And by saying, oh, I was just trying to get your attention, it was kind of like he was the mini-me of Sean Spicer claiming that President Trump had put wiretaps in quotes when he was talking about President
Obama.
Well,
and I will say, in the spirit of Sunshine Week, one of the things that was in one of the follow-up stories was the editor of the paper saying that, you know, the newspaper, or I'm sorry, that the mayor does this all the time. And my first thought was, maybe it's time to file a Freedom of Information Act request for the mayor's emails and see who else he's billed.
This is a good point. That would be a good point.
Okay. Well, one of the most popular segments ever on this program ran on January 7th, 2015, after Jay Wilds, a key witness in the murder trial of Adnan Syed, he had testified as part of the podcast Serial. That program has been credited with resurrecting podcasts and their popularity among listeners, making them mainstream. And now for the first time in 2 years, people across the country seem to have a new podcast obsession, Missing Richard Simmons. Have you been listening to it yet?
I didn't listen to it until you brought it to my attention, and it is fascinating, and in part because I remember the whole Richard Simmons craze.
When he
was sweating to the oldies, and then it made me think, well, wait a minute, what did happen to him? And this podcast sort of deals with that.
Mm-hmm.
But you never really hear from him, which keeps the mystery going.
Right, because he's been in seclusion.
Right.
I haven't heard it, but it's now going to be required listening on, you know, on iTunes for me, because, you know, you've got this guy who's producing it who was a friend of Richard Simmons,
right,
who also worked for Dateline NBC for a while. Then he worked for The Daily Show. And his take, I'm sure, must be pretty interesting on this whole thing. Although I don't know that we'll ever know whether or not Richard Simmons is being held hostage
well,
in his home or
I
not.
Well, I mean, there are stories on our link blog to talk about. He's not being held hostage. They've done a series of welfare checks on him.
Right, TMZ says police have gone and everything's fine and everything's great.
And he's basically saying, look, I just want to be left alone. I mean, there may be something else going on there, but Richard Simmons himself does not want the public
to
know.
So something else going on there. Let me ask you, as the conspiracy theorist I sometimes am, what do you think the chances are perhaps we're all being played, we're all being punked, and that at the end of this we find out this has all been the establishment of a comeback for Richard Simmons? And, you know, he comes out at the end of this and here he is, and we're back to Richard Simmons at the top of his game. And the nostalgia factor has gotten us all back into him.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, stranger things have happened.
Right.
Especially this year. So, you know, it could happen. It could happen.
I would like to think that might happen just because that would be a more fitting ending for him than, say, what happened to Casey Kasem in a case of very much like
yeah.
this.
Yes,
except
yes,
he died lonely, away from his kids, away from health care. So maybe this will have a better ending.
If not, what's the payoff? So the time we're all putting in and listening to it. Well, even the most casual TV news viewer knows that things get a little more sensational come November, February, and May during ratings periods. A station's performance during a ratings period is what sets the rates it can charge for advertising and can literally make or break a station. So it's no coincidence that's also when we see reporters doing things you might not otherwise ever see. Like this idea from the news director at WNEM-TV in the market that covers Saginaw and Flint, Michigan. He sent a memo to his newsroom looking for volunteers who might be willing to dress up as either an Orthodox Jewish male or a Muslim woman in traditional dress, or as a transgender person, to see how people in the nation would react to the reporter while in disguise. We all know the stories of Black Like Me or of the, you know, people going undercover to see what the experience might be, but no.
This is dumb. This is when someone else in the newsroom needs to raise their hand and go, wait a minute. We are about to violate almost every rule you could possibly imagine in just the respect of others and their cultures and their traditions and the way in which they live their lives. And for what? For ratings? What kind of story are you possibly going to get by doing this?
And what are we going to find out? That anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and transphobia
right.
exist.
Right. Why can't you just go out and talk to people?
Right. I mean, who experience it every single day.
Yeah. My problem is there a story to be told? Yes. Could you talk to people in the community? Yes. Could you even maybe get volunteers from the community if you want to do this hidden camera thing? I don't know. Maybe you could do that. But asking the folks at the station to dress up like, that's a dumb idea. And I also worry that with these sweep stories, we never get to the background or the context. We only get to the sensational part.
Right, because we only do it during sweeps. Yeah. We don't do it on a continuous basis. And therein lies the problem with stories like this, which is if you're out there covering that community every day, then you wouldn't have to do this. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue I have.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me ask you this. When you turn on the local news, you expect that it's produced locally, right? Well, TV viewers in Toledo might be surprised to find out that their local newscast is coming to them from a studio in, get this, South Bend, Indiana. That's right, Sinclair-owned WNWO-TV has a full staff of reporters in Toledo reporting on the ground, but its anchors are working out of a content generation hub in North Central Indiana. We've heard about station groups that create centralized hubs for the production of graphics or for feeding of national video, but for the actual production of a local newscast?
You know, this may surprise you, but I'm not really offended by this particular thing. I mean, there are things that I'm offended by in terms of cutbacks in news, and I have concerns about Sinclair as a company in terms of some of the political positions their management has taken over time. But let's just think about this for a second. The reporters are still in Toledo. Mm-hmm. The producers of the newscasts are still in Toledo. The technical staff and their anchor people are in South Bend, where they've got a much nicer facility so they can slick up this newscast and maybe make it more interesting to their viewers. What's wrong with that? I mean, this is a station that was an also-ran station in this market it forever. They've never gotten very many eyeballs. So here's a chance to say, we're going to keep the people that really matter, the people who come up with the story ideas, who report the stories, who package them in entertaining ways. They're going to still be in the market, but we're going to do some of this other stuff out of market. I don't care. It's okay by me.
Well, you know, I kind of agree with Mike a little bit on this. As long as you're transparent about it, as long as the people who are watching.
But they're really not being.
Well,
if you go to the station's website, the bios that are there for the two main anchors are very generically written about what the people enjoy doing and how excited they are to bring Toledo the news.
But to me, there lies the problem. If you're not going to be transparent about it, now you have an issue. But I do understand that. If you still want to keep the station going, but you got to cut your overhead, this might be a way to do that. As long as you still keep those reporters there covering the news and providing that news and information to that local market.
I mean, they are taking a risk. And I could be wrong about this, but I've been saying for a long time that the way people are going to be consuming television news in the not too distant future is going to be a lot different than the way they consume it now.
There's a lot of truth in that.
Now, anchors have always, the traditional wisdom has been that your local anchors are more important to drawing loyal viewers than the actual content of the news stories you produce. If we're moving away from that toward, I'm going to watch the stories you produce, if those stories are meaningful, relevant, engaging to me, and I don't need all the trappings of the anchors and the extra sports cast that runs 3 or 4 minutes when I really don't care to see all of that, the weather forecast that takes 10 minutes to get to what's the forecast?
Yeah.
I'd be happy to and I think it's going that direction where young people especially are not watching local TV newscasts the way that our generation did, and that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
So here's my concern, because I do still have one. I'm not necessarily as accepting of this concept as the two of you are. One of the biggest complaints we've had over time is Gannett has swallowed up newspapers, that, you know, a lot of local news values, a lot of local news flavor begin to go away. And if this goes on at one station within Sinclair, and I believe Sinclair owns at least 100, if not more TV stations, what keeps them from moving the news from our market, because they own KRCG in Jefferson City, moving that to South Bend as well, and then local television news also becomes even more so the cookie cutter that we have today, as opposed to that very community-centric.
I mean, you know, my argument would be that we're going to get what we deserve. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, I'm more worried about, say, local newspaper companies like the Gatehouse that came in here, and we've got far fewer reporters at the Tribune than we used to have.
Right.
So they're cutting back on the meat, you know, not the fat. And that's what I hope that won't happen with these TV newscasts.
Well, I'm hoping that doesn't happen with them too, but I would not be surprised if that is the case, because content is usually what is impacted when you start making these kinds of moves.
Okay, well, that music means we're pretty much out of time. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Our original theme music was composed by Tim Pilcher. Lauren Wortman is our associate producer, and I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.